Maybe I just I mention a couple of quick things, that just a couple of projects that I'm doing that maybe give you a couple of ideas. And I know there are many, many ideas in the room here about where we stand at this moment in theater and where we can go and what the overwhelming possibilities are. I should just, by way of a asterisk, mention that I myself didn't think I was going to have anything to do with theater. My main interest when I was a kid was snakes. And then when I was 10, there was a 13-year-old who was so cool, and he apprenticed at a marionette theater. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, steel town, industrial heartland of America. It's empty now. Nobody has a job there. 3 out of the 4 stores in the part of Pittsburgh I grew up in are boarded up right now. And the steel mills are quiet. But then, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, working class city, on Ellsworth Avenue, there was a little garage where the woman who owned it had painted the interior fuchsia and covered it with puppets and masks from all over the world. And as a kid in Pittsburgh, you could see these Balinese masks and these Javanese shadow puppets and these Indian faces and these African masks. It was a whole world you couldn't see in Pittsburgh. And the woman who ran the theater every year went to some part of the world to learn. She studied at the State Central Puppet Theater in Moscow under Obrazov. She went to the Yucatan. She went to Osaka and studied the Bunraku. And every year would bring back to Pittsburgh some part of the world. And when I was 13, she said to me, "Now, Peter, you really have to know the scenography of Josef Svoboda." And I was introduced to the Czech and then to the Polish avant-garde by this woman running a little theater in a garage in Pittsburgh, creating this amazing fuchsia space in a very gray world. This space that was a total release. And, of course, a real tradition, because it was part of the Midwestern Commedia dell'arte, of these touring puppet theaters. I learned Punch and Judy from the original handed-on script. And, of course, my first show, the kids cried. I did it all wrong. And then I learned. But I also learned because we would perform in shopping malls. And I would... Part of my theatrical apprenticeship in my teens was to do 6 shows a day in a downtown shopping center. And you learn fast. You learn how to make people stop as they're walking by. You learn how to make them stand there for the next half hour. And most crucially, you learn how to have them put money in the hat at the end. Because that is really important for dinner. And you learn real theater skill. And you learn not to judge the audience, but you actually learn to perform for everyone. Everyone who's just walking by the shopping center. And you learn to deal with everyone equally and powerfully. My other apprenticeship, maybe I should just mention quickly, is I was adopted by a group of singers in my 20s. And for 10 years, they hired me to stage their operas. And they were based at Emanuel Church in Boston, which is one of the original churches of the Underground Railroad and one of the founders of the AA movement in America. There were, while we were rehearsing Mozart and Handel there, there were 4 AA chapters, a shelter for battered women, a homeless food program, a Salvadoran refugee program, because this was the Reagan era and the United States was at war with Salvadoran refugees. And so you're rehearsing every day above the AA meeting, and you begin to realize, oh right, maybe Don Giovanni is about addiction. and you're next to the shelter for battered women, and it hits you that, oh, right, maybe that's why the Countess doesn't appear before noon. And you begin to just realize, oh, and the other thing I should mention, they performed the complete Bach cantatas now about 8 times. Every Sunday, another one. And you realize that Bach wrote most of his music not as some beautiful abstract gesture, but to talk someone out of committing suicide that week, which is what those cantatas are, which is dealing with people's issues in a kind of musical 12-step program. And that was good enough for Bach. And so that was my other apprenticeship, where you realize why art exists. It's actually to deal, rather than not to deal. It's to deal. Can we now deal? And can we create this space for some honesty where, let's face it, most things are basically dishonest? So I mentioned, for example, a project I did the last 2 years, the play by Euripides, The Children of Heracles, which, of course, the classicists claim can't be a finished play, because it could never end the way it ends. And believe me, Euripides knows exactly what he's doing, where he ends it. But it's about refugees. And I think it's one of the most intense questions, immigration, right now. It's tearing every country in the world apart. People keep acting like it's temporary. And I want to say, excuse me, it's permanent. Get with it. Stop acting like there's some temporary stopgap solution. No, it is permanent all over the world. Now, can we grow up and deal with this? Euripides wrote this play 2,500 years ago. It's a shocker. It's Heracles, you know, the strong man, ended his life with the 12 laborers, basically at hard labor, basically forced labor, basically slave labor, being asked to do something no human being can do, which actually a lot of kids around the world can identify with their father killing himself to do work that is inhuman. Their father, who was strong, but who in the world was weak. His kids survive, and the king who imposed the labors on Hercules decides he wants to kill the kids too. The kids run for their lives with their grandmother and an old fighting companion of Hercules, and they go from country to country in Europe seeking asylum. The king of Crete has an ambassador arriving ahead of them in every country saying, if you let these people in, we will declare war on you. So they are turned away from every country they apply to. Then they arrive at Athens, and the Greeks say, our gates are open, of course. Welcome, this is a place of asylum. Then the messenger arrives, and the Greeks have this amazing conversation in which the citizens of Athens decide it is worth going to war to protect the rights of refugees and immigrants. I mean, it's just shocking. And then Euripides really starts to dig in. I won't tell you right now what happens. I would just only say, for me, it was an attempt to make in this production, which we did in 8 countries, an honest space in the famous immigration debate, which is a non-debate because nothing real is ever being debated. People are name-calling and acting like there are no alternatives, and nobody's being completely honest in my country, which is a country made of immigrants, for God's sake. What are we saying? So one of the things we tried to do was, and one of the things I've learned across the years is, we try and do it in rehearsal. Can we now do it for our communities? Make a space where some kind of honesty is possible, where people can put down their false identity and say something honest. In the case of immigrants and immigration judges, there has to this day never been an honest conversation. As you know, the refugees have been told by the EU, we accept the following three stories. So even if that's not your story, it's the story you have to tell in order to be accepted as a refugee. Meanwhile, the guidelines for the judges are shocking and against your own human impulse. The result is, in an immigration interview, both sides are lying. And at the heart of our policy is dishonesty, because the whole society is being dishonest about the deeper questions. So one of the things we did with the Children of Heracles was create every night a space at the beginning of the show. The first hour of the show would be the Minister of the Interior and three African refugees in conversation for an hour. The most important part of that was, of course, I had to meet all of these people and work with them for weeks, in some cases months before, to prepare that conversation, so that conversation was not just the usual empty gesture, just the way you would with actors. And the most important thing that happened, the audience never saw, was those people having dinner beforehand and getting to know each other over dinner. Two men who both had daughters. Just starting with something basic between the Minister of the Interior and this African refugee. We had nights where the police from detention centers, border guards, narcotics police, the companies that run these private prisons where these people are interned, I'm using polite language at the moment. Every part of the corrupt system, and people who, of course, nobody's stupid. A border guard knows the emptiness of what they're doing. What does it take to admit that in public? What does it take to say, this is what I know is the truth about my job? And this is where I know my job is untrue. And can you have a conversation about that in public with the immigrants themselves and begin to get the truth of their story? Every night, that was the first hour of Children of Heracles. As I mentioned, in eight countries. Every night, different people, because, of course, only actors can do subsequent performances. And with people who are not actors, it has to be one time only. But working with a huge swath of the government, of the NGOs, of the community organizations, and then within the immigrant communities themselves, who have a lot to say. But, of course, when they're standing at the bus stop, no one will say a word to them. You've looked at those African guys, you've never said a word to them. They feel your eyes, they've never had your conversation. Can we, as theater, the place that is a shared space for the community, create the shared space where all of these members of the community feel at home, that they do live here? And can we explore together what it is we might share? Every night, this first hour was one of the most amazing things I've ever experienced in my life, because there were these unexpected ways in which truth would appear. Then the audience had a break, some coffee, and they came back for a play written 2,500 years ago, where in the first 10 minutes of the play, you said, oh my God, that is why poetry exists. Everything that was missing from the first hour suddenly was provided by Euripides, the nobility that we were mentioning. And at the same time, the audience is suddenly listening to every word and every line in that play with incredible heightened attention, because suddenly they know what's at stake because of the real lives that they've just entered in the previous hour. And so what would have gone by as a long speech in a Greek play, suddenly the audience is on the edge of their seat with the nuance of the debate and the discussion. And following the moral line of it with incredible acuity. And suddenly you have an audience for a Greek play paying attention. And there are no empty gestures. Every night I had 27 refugee kids, they're called officially minors, unaccompanied minors, you know, who are taken off of planes and put in these kind of camps by our society. I had 27 of them on stage every night. They were the children of Heracles. Euripides is so brilliant because he has them silent all night. They're looking at you, and you're looking at them, and they know more about you than you know about them. And meanwhile, as in real life, about their future, they're not being consulted. Everyone else is going to talk about it. And then Euripides does something so amazing. When the citizens of Athens finally let them into the country, they leave the stage and they go out through the audience. Thank you for letting me into your country. Through the whole audience. It is the first time in their lives that people in those audiences have touched an African person, have touched a Kurdish person, where somebody looks in your eye and you look in their eye, and we're both people. And it's an act of gratitude. And that's Euripides. Every night, it's just incredible to watch that moment in the show because the audience would have... The audience was so scared when these kids, these problem kids, came off the stage. Some people held their arms really tight and refused. Very, very interesting. Anyway, then during the show, another group of refugees every night was cooking. And at the end of the show, we all crossed the street to a eating space. And there was food for the audience, for the performers, for the refugees. And the audience found themselves, everybody, we all just ate together. And suddenly you were at a table with three African kids. And you were having dinner. And by that point in the night, 5 hours later, there were no barriers. We had created a shared space, and there was the beginning of a community. Now, I just mentioned that project. It's just a type of strategy for what we can do with our theaters. What we can offer, what we can be as the meeting place for people who haven't met, as the gathering place for people who haven't gathered, as the sharing space for people who haven't shared, as a hearth in a cold world, and as a place where we create an environment where extremely difficult things can be worked through together. You know Euripides by reputation. He doesn't let anyone off the hook. The play goes to a couple of really difficult places that I won't detail for you at the moment. But the audience gets a serious workout. And their motives are tested very intensely. And of course, as in every Euripides play, there's a giant speech against money. And maybe I'll just mention one more thing if I could. Just one other Greek play. I don't know why I'm on the Greeks today, but there we are. Another play I did that I should just mention, an approach to intercultural work, because I do believe right now we're sharing the planet. It's one planet. People are building walls in some parts of the world. It's really the wrong time to try and do that, because you can't build any wall high enough right now. And so it's now the time to figure out. You know, I think if Mozart had only been able to hear Chinese music and to hang out with African drummers, you know, we are living in an amazing world where our friends are Chinese and African, where, in fact, we can know what's going on in Tiananmen Square that day. Where no event in the world is beyond our grasp. Well, let's say reach. Grasp is another thing. And yet, how much of this is reflected in most of our cultural institutions? Almost none. It's so rare to see the world that we're really living in reflected in most museum programs, in most, you know, and so on. In fact, it's an astonishing time to be alive, where you can have, you know, get to know the next George Washington, who is a Korean girl who's 22 years old. And we can get to know her now. It's an amazing moment to be alive. But how do we cross the cultural barrier? How do we get to this place where the world can be shared? Again, theater is the way to build the kind of serious bridges of engaging with people as equals, because theater is about creating the eye of equality, the zone of equality, where no two human beings are unequal, but quite the opposite. Theater deals with the fact we are so equal. But that means having to look beyond the usual inequalities and find that place where people are equal. And that takes work. Maybe I mentioned in the first Gulf War, I did a play by Aeschylus, the first existing play in Western drama, about the Persians. The Greeks won the Persian War, slaughtered them, hands down, no problem. And then they came back home, and Aeschylus presented them with a play about the enemy. All the people they just defeated also thought they were right, also prayed to God, also had families. Hello. And it's an amazing play where you confront the audience with the people they've just triumphantly defeated, and where you realize the measure of the stature of the victor is how you treat the loser. And how you create a world in which nobody has to lose in the future. Because if there's a victor, there will be a loser. And so already we have a problem. In the Persians, as you probably know, there was the famous, the first Gulf War had the famous Highway of Death, where 150,000 column, 150,000 Iraqi soldiers on this big highway in the desert that was just a great way the Pentagon could test all their new weapons. They had these incredible weapons, you know, the bombs that suck your lungs out, and it's amazing stuff. I mean, again, it's incredible to see the effort people will go to inflict pain. You know, that like napalm, it's not just that you die. It's important that you die in excruciating agony for several weeks first. Like, who invents this stuff? Who invents the cluster bomb? Who invents uranium-tipped bullets? Anyway, as you probably recall, the Highway of Death, the images are just horrifying, and the photos were not permitted to be shown. The Observer published one, and then there was round censor everywhere. The guy who took the photos is a photographer named Ken Jaretsky. I contacted him in Montana. I said, look, we're making something about the Gulf War. Could we use your photos? And the photos, he said, sure, because they could not be printed in America. So he sent the photos. The photos were truly unspeakable. I mean, just human beings dying in a kind of agony you cannot imagine. And the last image. And there was no way we could use them. Absolutely no way. When you saw it. And I had the big question of how to represent the 150,000 soldiers. So I engaged Martinez Miroto, who is a Javanese court performer who won the trophy as the greatest refined male dancer in Java, and also specializes in spirit possession ritual, which involves expertise with a drum, knowing when the spirit of a deceased person, someone who died in pain, enters the body of a living person and can express what they couldn't express before they died. And the community can hear it. And it's one way of removing a curse, both from them and from the community, is the acknowledgement of the way somebody died. And as you know, most theater from most cultures was never meant to be performed for living people. Theater's roots, and in China and Korea, it still is this way, it's a performance for the dead. It's to tell the dead that we remember them, that we haven't forgotten, and we know they did not die well. Miroto brought these photographs every night to his dressing room in the theater, and before the performance, created a ceremony with offerings, with candles. Every night he would pick a different photograph, and he would invite the spirit of that person who died in unbearable agony to enter his body that night. And he would express our love and our care and our sadness for this person. Miroto went on stage as one person representing 150,000 soldiers. We performed this in America. The audiences were devastated. And they had seen all kinds of war footage on television. And as you know, there's a murder every 3 seconds on American television. People are inured to violence. What does it take to actually have people freshly experience it deeply, but in a way that, unlike Hollywood, doesn't just perpetuate the violence they claim to be criticizing? The audiences couldn't watch Miroto. It was unbearable for them. He went right under the skin. And again, this was performing of such honor, such power. And at the end of the night, the spirit of that person was released. Theater is shaman ceremony. Of course. It's an exorcism of our own demons and the demons around us. Act of love to people who died in pain. The city of Vienna has this year invited me to create a festival for the 250th birthday of Mozart. I said, okay, as long as there's not one note of Mozart. I took the things that Mozart was working on in the last year of his life. The last year of his life is an important year because, of course, Mozart was one of the most famous people in Europe until his political views were too visible. And suddenly, all the commissions stopped. Mozart was the composer of radical equality and social inclusion. He created the quartet, the musical form in which four unequal people, count, servant, countess, servant, are suddenly equal because they're sharing the same music. Mozart couldn't get work. It's unbelievable to think of it. And he had to leave Vienna as an economic migrant, going from city to city in Europe looking for work. He didn't find any, hoping to send money home to his family. For 1 year of his life, this year, Mozart wrote no music. Now, we think of music just pouring out of Mozart's, you know, ears. Mozart wrote music like it just poured out of him. For 1 year, the experience of being an economic migrant was so devastating, even Mozart could not write music. And at the end of a year, he came back to Vienna with nothing, to be with his family. And he wrote a little song called Longing for Spring in January. And it's, of course, what we all share. A hope for a political thaw. We know it in Tiananmen. We know it in Prague. This longing for spring. In Chinese art, the great image is the plum blossom. The plum blossom is the first blossom that comes out in February, surrounded by ice and snow, to say, this will not last forever. There will be spring. This must change. And those blossoms, of course, pay with their lives. For their early appearance. And that's why you will see for centuries of Chinese art and poetry, the plum blossom. That is what that means. It's the human beings who are courageous enough to arrive ahead of schedule to say there will be change. There must be change. And usually they are killed by the next frost. And then Mozart wrote three works, The Magic Flute, Magic, Transformation. What is magic in a society where nothing else works? And what are the trials by fire and water of a young generation right now? La Clemenza di Tito, response to terrorism. Act one, the terrorists set fire to the city and assassinate the president. Act two, the president miraculously recovers, says, bring me the people who did this. There's a giant roundup, they're brought before him. He does three things. He forgives them. He deals with their issues, invites them to join the government, because until they have both responsibility and representation, no one will ever be safe. That's Mozart, 1791. We all thought that was ridiculous until Nelson Mandela became president of South Africa and formed a government with the people who tried to kill him. And then finally, requiem ceremonies for the dead. In this time we live in, where every week new mass graves are opened, what will the ceremonies be in our generation for the disappeared? For the people who died incorrectly? What ceremonies will give both them and us the permission to move forward? Next November and December, for 4 weeks in Vienna, I've commissioned artists from all over the world, from Cambodia, from Congo, from Paraguay, from Chad, places where people are coming through genocide and civil war, where we all need to turn the page, and the politicians are incapable of doing it. That page is a cultural page that needs to be turned. We all need a new page to begin writing the next chapter. Let's try and offer that to our fellow citizens.